Abraham Lincoln, Chapter 13, Re-election of Lincoln. Although the tide of war had turned at Gettysburg, the crisis was not marked, as Lincoln had wished, by an emphatic wreckage of Confederate hopes. He had watched with earnest longing to see the retreating army so overwhelmed that they would be unable ever again to mass their forces for another encounter. But, as we have told elsewhere, Meade disappointed his chief and let Lee retreat safely into Virginia. You remember how sorely disappointed and exasperated the president had been at another escape of the enemy after the Battle of Antietam, an escape which seemed to him needless, and how disheartened he became in his long, vain search for a responsible general to lead the Union armies. But as one of his admirers said, Lincoln always had a card up his sleeve, and just now, even in this crushing disappointment, he was not without resource. Vicksburg, you remember, had fallen the day following the Battle of Gettysburg, and the president had been watching with keen interest the military progress of its hero, General Ulysses S. Grant. As this resolute commander pushed his campaign down the river, never resting until victory was won, he held as a magnet the anxious attention of the president, for here was a man after his own heart. The modest general was too busy achieving to send full reports of all he was doing. Lincoln said of him a few weeks after the capture of Vicksburg, "General Grant is a copious worker and fighter, but a very meager writer and telegrapher." But the president found a way to get news of what he wanted to know, and it was not many weeks before he believed he had found the right man in the silent, aggressive hero of Vicksburg. Grant had first recommended himself to the thoughtful notice of the president at the time of the capture of Forts Henry and Donelson in February 1862 by his reply to the Confederate commander of Fort Donelson, who had asked for terms of surrender. Grant had promptly sent back the answer, "No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted. I propose to move immediately on your works." The fort was surrendered with 15,000 men. This terse message must have been a refreshing draught to the commander-in-chief, at that time wearied and harassed in his vain prodding of the overcautious McClellan. He showed his appreciation by appointing Grant major general. In the train of success followed petty jealousies, and reports came to the president of Grant's unfitness for his position, his enemies accusing him of intemperate habits. Unshaken in his confidence, Lincoln replied to his informers, "Tell me the brand of his whiskey, and I will send it to my other generals." And to another he said, "This man fights. I can't spare him." In November 1863, after the capture of Vicksburg, by brilliant strategy, Grant overwhelmingly defeated Bragg at Chattanooga. These achievements had so definitely marked him for promotion that Lincoln sent for him in the early spring of 1864 to come to Washington, where he received the appointment of lieutenant general, giving him command under the direction of the president of all the Union armies. On March 9, 1864, the president formally presented his commission with these words, "General Grant, the nation's appreciation of what you have done and its reliance upon you for what remains to do in the existing great struggle are now presented with this commission, constituting you lieutenant general in the Army of the United States. With this high honor devolves upon you also a corresponding responsibility. As the country trusts you, so under God it will sustain you. I scarcely need to add that with what I here speak for the nation goes my own hearty personal concurrence." General Grant replied, "Mr. President, I accept with gratitude this commission for the high honor conferred. With the aid of the noble armies that have fought on so many fields for our common country, it will be my earnest endeavor not to disappoint your expectations. I feel the full weight of the responsibilities now devolving on me, and know that if they are met, it will be due to those armies and above all to the favor of that providence which leads both nations and men. In accordance with the wishes of the President, Grant was not only to have the entire military conduct of the war, but also the personal control of the Virginia campaign against Lee. It is understood that before accepting his appointment, Grant insisted that he must not be interfered with in his military duties. However that may be, we know he was left free to carry out his own plans in his own way. Lincoln himself offered suggestions, but never gave orders. Having found the man upon whose ability and judgment he relied, he was willing to trust him. We get some insight into the relations between the two men from the notes they exchanged just before the opening of the campaign, when Grant was about to advance against Lee's army early in May. The President's frank note ran as follows: "Not expecting to see you again before the spring campaign opens, I wish to express in this way my entire satisfaction with what you have done up to this time, so far as I understand it. The particulars of your plan I neither know nor seek to know. You are vigilant and self-reliant, and, pleased with this, I wish not to obtrude any constraints or restraints upon you. While I am very anxious that any great disaster or capture of our men in great numbers shall be avoided, I know these points are less likely to escape your attention than they should be mine. If there is anything wanting which is within my power to give, do not fail to let me know it. And now, with a brave army and a just cause, may God sustain you." General Grant made answer: "From my first entrance into the volunteer service of the country to the present day, I have never had cause of complaint, have never expressed or implied a complaint against the administration or the Secretary of War for throwing embarrassment in the way of my vigorously prosecuting what appeared to be my duty. Indeed, since the promotion which placed me in command of all the armies, and in view of the great responsibility and importance of success, I have been astonished at the readiness with which everything asked for has been yielded, without even an explanation being asked. Should my success be less than I desire and expect, the least I can say is, the fault is not yours." These two notes reveal a mutual understanding between Grant and Lincoln that was most valuable in the conduct of the war. They were both simple, direct, honest, and straightforward, and each respected the good qualities of the other. It must therefore have been with confidence and keen satisfaction that Lincoln now looked forward to the outcome of the campaign as Grant's army started south toward Richmond. This was the first time since the opening of the war that Lincoln felt released from himself aiding in the work of planning and directing military movements. For now he had not only a lieutenant general who held the full measure of his confidence, but also tried and trusted generals in subordinate fields. Next to Grant, General William Tecumseh Sherman, who was to lead the army in the West, was the most conspicuous for his military successes. There was also the dashing young cavalry leader, General Philip H. Sheridan, Phil Sheridan, as his admirers like to call him, who won the brilliant victory at Cedar Creek, and General George H. Thomas, well known as the Rock of Chickamauga, because of his stubborn defense in that battle. Meantime, Lincoln's political problems were pressing and were affecting his prospects of re-election. It was his earnest desire to carry to a successful finish the work of the war. His friends knew that he wished the nomination, but there was opposition from many quarters. With that unselfishness that was always present with him, he said to Thurlow Weed, "Is there any man in the Democratic Party who can push this war one step farther or faster than I? Because if there is, I want him to take my place." It is not necessary to go into details about all the complaints that were made, although, as we are to see later, a fruitful cause of much of the censure and abuse was the draft. All through the dreary, dragging months of the war, there had been continuous, unfavorable criticism. When generals disappointed and battles went wrong, the dissatisfaction and anger of all parties were heaped upon Lincoln. He was called inefficient, weak, irresolute. Murmurs and reproaches came from all directions and centered on him. One of the most influential leaders working against him was Horace Greeley, and at this time he was favoring the choice of one of Lincoln's generals to succeed him. But the general was loyal to Lincoln. In Lincoln's own official family was one who aspired to the presidency, even though he would be supplanting his chief, and he was silently working to that end. This was Salmon P. Chase, Secretary of the Treasury. Although Lincoln knew of his personal disloyalty, he still held him in office because he was a faithful servant. Another possible rival gave Lincoln more uneasiness, for he felt the man's worth and knew that his success was occasioning widespread enthusiasm. This was General Grant. But Grant was thoroughly devoted to Lincoln and said to those who approached him on the subject that he would not accept the nomination if it was offered to him. Through state legislatures and caucuses, however, the people, more sagacious than their political leaders, were demanding Lincoln. They had confidence in him because he had taken pains that they should understand him. His letters in answer to public criticism had been a powerful means of acquainting the public with his policy, for they were always so frank and so clearly and simply expressed that they were very convincing. His stories and maxims, too, went much farther than studied arguments. One of his sayings, "Never swap horses while crossing a stream," was repeated by the newspapers all over the country. It appealed to the people's sense of humor by its quaintness, and was most helpfully applied at this time to the changing of presidents during the war. Lincoln's stories often contained the strongest arguments. Underlying them was the convincing truth that goes with solid reasoning. He used a story not only to clinch a point, but to put a situation in a concrete way, and often by a touch of humor to avert hard feeling. It has well been said that many of his stories contained the wisdom of ancient parables. But in his storytelling, Lincoln was often misunderstood, especially by those who were lacking in a sense of humor themselves. A good example of this appears in the following incident. On one occasion, when a congressman came to the White House to present to the president a serious complaint, Lincoln began to tell a story. The man made an indignant protest. Lincoln, deeply pained, said with feeling, "I have great confidence in you and great respect for you, and I know how sincere you are, but if I couldn't tell these stories, I should die." This simple statement changed the congressman's indignation into sincere sympathy for President Lincoln. Though it was declared that not one Republican in 10 of the most earnest members of the Senate favored Lincoln, and though the Speaker of the House said that Lincoln had but one strong political friend in the House, yet, when the Republican National Convention met early in June, he received a renomination by an overwhelming majority on the first ballot, a strong proof that the people were heart and soul with the president. In the meanwhile, what of campaigns and battles? A few words will explain the military situation in the summer of 1864. Early in May, as you will recall, Grant began his campaign against Lee in Virginia. When he crossed the Rapidan and entered the Wilderness, every foot of his advance was hotly contested by Lee's army. The fighting was terrible and the Union losses enormous, but with unyielding determination, Grant pressed on, writing to the president his stubborn resolve, "I propose to fight it out on this line if it takes all summer." It did take all summer and more, for Grant found it impossible to capture Richmond by attacking it on the north side. He therefore transferred his army across the James River and attacked the city from the south. But at the end of the summer, Lee still held on. The Union losses were something like 60,000. Some said, "Grant is failing." Many bitterly censured Lincoln also. They declared with emphasis, "He is not strong enough for his task. He is lacking in practical talent." Still, the bloody fighting went on, and Lee managed his army with such skill and his men fought with such bravery that Grant made only slow progress. The Confederates still held Richmond. It was a period of bitter disappointment and discouragement for those who were loyal to the Union cause. The hostile critics declared, as they had been doing for many months, that the military policy of the administration was a failure, that the war had been dragging on year after year with an enormous waste of material goods and human life, and that it was dragging on because the president was weak as an executive. Their attitude seemed to be justified because neither Grant nor Sherman had, up to the last of August 1864, done anything which the country looked upon as noteworthy. To be sure, Grant had advanced toward Richmond, but he had not captured the city, nor did it look as though he would capture it. Likewise, Sherman had made a steady advance toward Atlanta, but he had not captured Atlanta. In fact, the summer of 1864 was a dark one for the people of the North. In the midst of the constantly increasing gloom over the failure of the Union armies, a meeting of the National Executive Committee of the Republican Party was held in New York City. After the meeting, the chairman of the committee, Henry J. Raymond, who was the editor of the New York Times and a loyal supporter of the administration, wrote to Mr. Lincoln as follows: "I am in active correspondence with your staunchest friends in every state, and from them all I hear but one report. The tide is setting strongly against us." For this unfortunate state of affairs, he gave two reasons. One, the want of military success, and two, the impression in some minds and the fear and suspicion in others that we are not to have peace in any event under this administration until slavery is abandoned. In some way or other, the suspicion is widely diffused that we can have peace with Union if we would. It was August 23rd, the day on which this letter probably reached President Lincoln, that he wrote upon a piece of paper the following memorandum: Executive Mansion, Washington, August 23rd, 1864. This morning, as for some days past, it seems exceedingly probable that this administration will not be re-elected. Then it will be my duty to so cooperate with the president-elect as to save the Union between the election and the inauguration, as he will have secured his election on such ground that he cannot possibly save it afterward. A. Lincoln. When his cabinet met, he handed the folded paper to all the members, who signed their names on the outside without knowing what he had written. Lincoln's action in this case was characteristic. He always wished to keep faith with his better self. He was always troubled until he had decided, after carefully weighing all the facts involved, just what it was right for him to do. But when he had reached his decision, nothing could turn him from his purpose. 6 days after Lincoln wrote the memorandum mentioned above, something occurred which caused much anxious thought on the part of Mr. Lincoln's friends. This was the meeting in Chicago of the Democratic National Convention. There were two strong factions present, the War Democrats and the Peace Democrats. The latter was powerful enough to force into the platform, although in the face of stubborn and even bitter opposition, a peace plank. This declared that, after 4 years of failure to restore the Union by the experiment of war, justice, humanity, liberty, and the public welfare demand that an immediate effort be made to stop the fighting on the battlefield and to call a convention of the states with the purpose of restoring peace at the earliest practical moment on the basis of the Federal Union of the States. To the extent of getting this peace plank into the platform, then the Peace Democrats scored a point. But the War Democrats had a greater success, for they brought about the nomination of their favorite candidate, General McClellan. He accepted the nomination, but in his letter of acceptance he expressly repudiated the so-called peace plank. Amid all this political doubt and fear, the president never wavered. He was determined, above all else and whatever cost, to save the Union. The cost would surely be heavy, both in money and men. But he would save it even if he had to resort to another draft, or, as his enemy said, to act the part of a military dictator by authorizing arbitrary arrests of people who criticized the government, or by stopping for a time the publication of hostile newspapers. His present unpopularity with this group of critics was due to his already having resorted to such measures, and especially to the draft. To make this clear, let us go back a little. When the war broke out, more volunteers offered their services than were thought necessary. But before the end of the second year, the war had grown so unpopular or doubtful of result that volunteering had almost entirely ceased. So few battles had been won by Union armies that men lost heart. And besides, nearly all the young men without families to support had already gone into the war, so that volunteering now meant a severe sacrifice. To meet the serious situation, Congress passed a Conscription Act in March 1863. This draft itself, which affected all able-bodied male citizens between 18 and 45 years of age, was begun in the early part of the following summer. The result in New York City was a terrible riot lasting 4 days. Before it could be brought under military control, the mob, in its savage madness and fury, had destroyed property to the value of $1,500,000, and something like 1,000 people had been killed or wounded, many of whom were Negroes. Governor Seymour of New York State urged President Lincoln to suspend the draft, but Mr. Lincoln wisely refused. The necessity was imperative. Moreover, in 1864, he ordered further drafts, simply because he saw no other way to supply the Union armies with much-needed men. One of these drafts, which was for 500,000 men, was ordered by Lincoln to take place in September. The shocking losses on the battlefield, especially in Grant's army in Virginia, had so depleted the Union armies that more men were absolutely necessary. Knowing that this draft was so odious to the people that it might injure Lincoln's chances of election, some of his friends urged him to suspend it until after Election Day. But he was not the man to think of his own interests if they interfered with the interests of the country, so he persisted in issuing the draft, although in so doing he knew he was risking his own re-election. In the midst of the uncertainty and discouragement of the hour, suddenly, the sunlight broke through the clouds, for in August, Farragut destroyed the forts in Mobile Bay and cut off the city from the outside world. In September, Sherman captured Atlanta, and in October, Sheridan, in a series of crushing victories, cleared the Shenandoah Valley of the enemy. These victories were most timely. They not only changed the military outlook, but they assured Lincoln's success at the polls early in November. Out of a total of 232 presidential electors chosen, 211 favored Lincoln. It was a splendid endorsement by the people and gave him the longed-for opportunity to finish his work. As we should expect, he accepted the well-earned tribute in a truly modest spirit. When on the night following his election he reached the White House, about 2 o'clock in the morning, he found a party of serenaders waiting for a speech. With characteristic honesty and simplicity, he said to them, "My friends, if I know my heart, my gratitude is free from any intent of personal triumph. I do not impugn the motive of anyone who opposed me. It is no pleasure for me to triumph over anyone. But I give thanks to the Almighty for this evidence of the people's resolution to stand by free government and the rights of humanity."